when you look at Europe right now and you see Macron was talking about sending troops, NATO troops and French troops to Ukraine to fight with Russia. And we know that German Bundeswehr officials were discussing attacking Crimean Bridge with German Taurus missiles. Do you think that we are going toward World War III?
Okay, I think we have to begin with facing certain realities, or at least they seem to be realities to me. After 2 years, a little bit over 2 years of war, the Russians are winning and the Ukrainians are losing. Any attempt to pretend otherwise shows a level of self-delusion or straight-out dishonesty. Either of which is an unacceptable quality in a serious political leader. Over the last 2 years, as the Russians prevailed, most of the time, one or two times, the Ukrainians seemed perhaps to be able to make some sort of response. But that never lasted very long, and it never was, effective in terms of the broader picture. Over these 2 years of Ukrainian loss and Russian victory, the West repeatedly escalated the war. Most of the time, the escalations took the form of threatening and then eventually delivering better, harsher weapons, missile systems, Patriot missile, HIMARS missiles, underwater drones, all of that. And likewise, there was a continuous series of sanctions, another weapon against Russia. Everything, and this is important for people to understand, everything failed. The military escalations failed. The financial sanction escalations failed. And so what you're seeing is the recognition, whether it be by Macron or Olaf Scholz or anybody else, a recognition that what they did failed. As politicians, this puts them in a very difficult position. They can either admit they failed and come up with some explanation that exonerates themselves, and there will be many who do that, or they can deny everything I've just said and pretend it isn't a failure and that they just have to continue. So we get the decision by Macron to float the idea of sending NATO troops, either by country or by NATO as a whole. That's an escalation. That's exactly what they said before they agreed to send F-16 fighter jets. They said they would never do such a thing. Before they sent medium range missiles, they said they would never do such a thing. They keep doing it because they don't want to admit the failure of their policies to this point. Now, I enjoy reminding people of a famous definition that goes like this: if you keep doing the same thing, even though the results are awful, it's a sign of insanity. It's a sign that you are unable to recognize what is happening to you. It's not a very positive definition, not a very positive sign, but I think it meets the criterion. The problem with all of these escalations is that each one becomes a bit more difficult. In other words, a bit larger portion of the population is beginning to be able to see what's going on, and therefore look at the government and realize that these are not national issues being resolved. These are politicians trying to save their own political situation. The European politicians at the top in countries like France, Germany, England, and to a lesser extent, Italy and Spain, the major countries, they were all right-wing supporters of fighting Russia in the Ukraine. So they are all in the same boat, some a bit more, some a bit less. But it's basically a group of conservative politicians that are now desperately trying to save a very dangerous situation. In that way, it bears a singular similarity to Mr. Netanyahu and his associates in Israel, who are in a very similar situation with their war over there. It's a different war, different issues, but the politicians that have worked themselves into a very bad corner and don't see how to get out, and therefore keep doing the same thing, hoping for a different result, that's this question of sanity in the realm of foreign policy. Israel's attack in Gaza has generated more and more opposition in more and more countries by more and more people, and yet they keep doing what is generating. That's a desperate hope that something magical will change all of this. And I'm sure they're planning unspeakable, horrible events to try to change this, but it hasn't worked. It just hasn't worked. And there ought to be, and there will eventually be, people who say so. In that regard, let me make sure that everyone is aware of a remarkable by-election in Britain. Last week, a critic of the war in Ukraine, a critic even more of the Israeli war in Palestine, George Galloway, ran in a by-election in Rochdale in England. And not only did he win on a program of stopping and reversing British policies in Ukraine and Israel, Gaza, but what's important is he ran on the Workers' Party, his own political party. He not only won, but he got more than twice the number of votes that the Conservative and Labour parties together got. I mean, this was way more than winning. This was a repudiation. Conservatives and Labour have exchanged parliamentary control for the last three quarters of a century, if not longer, with no serious challenge. Here comes somebody, a socialist, well known as a socialist, but also a fierce critic, not quiet, loud and strong. And even the person who came in second, and I believe there were five candidates, was neither Labour nor Conservative. So the number one and the number two, more than half the voters rejected the Conservatives and the Labour Party. This is a level of public repudiation of government that if it weren't for the desperate effort of the major media that are in bed with the leading right wing of the government, if it weren't for that, you would see the kind of amazement being honestly presented. What is going on? And the Prime Minister, Mr. Sunak, Rishi Sunak, speaking immediately after the vote, showing how badly his party had been defeated, attacks Galloway because we don't want extremism. A very bizarre thing to say when the majority of the people just voted for that, quote, extremism. What are you doing, denouncing the mass of people? Exactly. That's what he's doing. And Galloway nailed him for doing it in a way that if it weren't these people completely out of touch, would be embarrassing. Okay, so what does all of this tell us? Well, several things. Number one, the decision of Europe was a decision to back the leadership of the United States, because the United States took the position of helping the coup in Ukraine several years ago that brought in the Zelensky government. The key role was there played by Nuland from the United States. And this war was clearly pushed by and supported by the United States. There was some waffling, particularly by Olaf Scholz in the early hours and days of the war, which way would the Germans go? But they all lined up behind the United States. And it's clear why they did that. They are right-wing governments, so they would feel comfortable with the United States. They didn't want to think about what it might mean if the war was lost. They did not calculate the possibility that the war would be lost. Terrible, terrible political mistakes that they made. But now they are going to pay a much higher price than they would have if they had told the United States, we're not going to be against you, but we are not joining you. You're going to have to work this out in Ukraine yourself. You are the United States. Russia is our neighbor. We cannot afford what you are doing. They could have. Would have been difficult, but they could have done it. By choosing to go with the United States, they are now exposed. They are exposed as the junior partner of the United States in a losing war. Now, this is the third time they were a junior partner in Afghanistan and they lost. They were a junior partner in Iraq and they lost. Now they're a junior partner in Ukraine and they're losing again. Emerging from this, what the world has seen is that the United States' ability to control the world militarily, economically, and politically is significantly less than they thought it was. When I mentioned before, they miscalculated. They thought that they could destroy the Russian army in the military way and that they could destroy the Russian economy by the sanctions. They could do neither. And there's no sign that they're going to do either, with or without their escalations. It is assumed everywhere in the world, I do too, that the United States and Europe is not prepared to risk nuclear war because of Ukraine. I can assure you, as an American, that the vast majority of Americans do not know and do not care what goes on in Ukraine. But the idea of risking a nuclear war, which destroys everything for Ukraine, is one step too many, even for the politicians we have now, I think, and I hope. But the effect on the United States here is clear. The miscalculations have to be explained. Why did you miscalculate Russia's vulnerability militarily? Because you thought that because you dominate in long-range missiles and nuclear, all the other kinds of warfare somehow either wouldn't happen or you couldn't manage them. Wrong. A non-nuclear war with Russia on Russia's border, you lose. You don't win. You lose. They have the missiles. They have the artillery, they have the manpower, you lose. Do you really want an exercise in such loss? Do you really want to risk that if you lose the conventional fighting, you might have to seriously think about nuclear for Ukraine? Stop. This is not, makes no sense at all. And remember, the West gained all of the former communist countries from Poland in the north to Bulgaria in the south. The whole deal made between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin at the end of World War II has been undone. NATO has moved in, may have promised not to. That's what the Russians say. Perfectly possible. We'll never know. But I mean, you've gained everything. You want to fight a nuclear war about the last piece, Ukraine? No, no. So you miscalculate. You didn't understand. But that's not the biggest delusion. The biggest and most important delusion was about the sanctions. You didn't understand that Russia is a country that has a system of alliances that means something. The alliance with China, first of all, the alliance with India, the alliance with the BRICS nations, now including important places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and so on. Those countries are now prepared to oppose US policy and help Russia. Apparently, the United States and Western Europe hadn't known that, hadn't figured it out, hadn't understood it, hadn't understood that it might happen, let alone that it would happen. And there is no end of that cooperation in sight. And so Russia's economy is doing fine. The ruble is doing fine. Russia had a faster economic growth in the last 2 years than the United States did. Germany is in recession. The British economy is a disaster, and so on and so on. So you have misunderstood the economics of sanction war, and you've misunderstood the logistics of military war, and that's why you're losing. But for the whole world, this is a display that the world economy is no longer the plaything, the tool, the slave, if you like, of the United States, as it was. I understand it was that way, but it isn't anymore. Every dominant country in the history of the human race has lost its dominance sooner or later. And we're seeing it now in the world economy. I'm not surprised that Pakistan has applied for membership in the BRICS. My understanding is at least a dozen other countries have seriously begun to apply. There are new thoughts around the world about regional blocs that may emerge, Spain and Latin America, because of the history of their shared language and cultures, and so on and so on. But there is a reorganization of the world economy. You and I have spoken about it, the decline of the dollar, the development of alternative payment system, other than the SWIFT system that the United States organized after World War II, and so on and so on. And I think Europe, to be blunt, Europe made a strategic error from which they may not recover. There was a time and there was a way that Europe could have become really the third bloc, if you like, the United States and its allies, China and its allies, Europe and its allies. It would have required unification, real unification in Europe, and it probably would have meant Europe welcoming Russia into that operation, making them that much stronger and the China-Russia alliance that much weaker. You know, Europe has a larger population, you know, the EU has a larger population and a richer one than the United States. So they have resources, they have wealth. Yes, for 75 years, they've been the junior partner of the United States. But like everything else, that too can change. My guess, you're going to see growing political power in Europe turning against the policies that culminated in Ukraine, demanding what we all know, because it exists inside Germany, inside France, inside England. There exist significant political voices already that don't want any of this, either from the left, because they see the United States, or from the right with an anti-immigrant nationalist. Yeah, it'll be complicated, but it'll make it more and more difficult for the kind of center-right wing that controls now to hold on. That's why you see efforts by Olaf Scholz or Macron or Rishi Sunak to become more anti-immigrant in the hopes of weakening the extreme right, and then doing what they said about Galloway to attack the left and so on. But my guess is their own failures, the failure in the Ukraine, and now the failure to stop the killing in Gaza, the failure to get a ceasefire in Gaza, these are signs of a weakening that is unmistakable. And let me be clear. It's not just, you know, the G7 versus the BRICS. Every country, however small, however neutral, however a small part of one or the other empire, is asking itself the question now, which way is the wind blowing? These are not courageous people, most of them. And they want to be with whoever the winner is. And it's no longer clear. And in this case, it's clear that the United States cannot control Mr. Netanyahu, you know, a country of half a dozen million people. What? What? A country that depends on the United States militarily, economically, in every way. You can't control what these people do. You know, and that's going to be a terrible problem going forward, because these failures are so grievous. They've caused so much loss of life and of wealth that they're going to be talked about for years to come. You know, the Israelis are going to face a world in which they just went from the victims of a terrible Holocaust to the perpetrators of another one. Not as big, not yet. But what? What's going on? And the United States is going to confront what? The entire Arab world, the entire Muslim world, as the supporter of this? What? You really want to do this? This is what we call in the United States shooting yourself in the foot. This is not a smart way to move forward for people who call themselves realists or any other of these terms. This is a disaster. But for Europe, they have the risk that they, the politicians in power, have bet on the wrong horse. They have sided up with the United States at a time when that empire is going down. And let me give you a piece of futurism. Nobody in Europe is sorry about Brexit. The Europeans see Brexit as the desperate, self-deluded action of a conservative government trying to hold on to a declining British economy, an empire that's already long gone, by focusing people on Europe. And so they broke away from Europe and they expelled some Europeans. The very same thing that they are doing with immigrants from the Middle East and Africa. But we have an experiment. Britain did it. Britain broke away. And the reaction of most of the rest of Europe was, who cares? We will build an EU without Britain. Let Britain be with the United States. It'll make Britain that much weaker with the United States that it isn't part of Europe. They don't seem to care about that. Well, the same Europeans can do that to the United States. They can break away and build on themselves. The United States is a bigger player for them, but it's not at all clear what they will lose. Capitalists around the world, busily active in many countries, they're not sitting there quietly. They too are calculating where to put their next investment, where to locate their next factory, where to build their offices, what market to invest in. So by the decisions they make, they reinforce the shifting power. That's why American corporations are as enormously important in China as they are. The language that says China is doing this or that, I have to remind my audiences, at least until recently, roughly half of the goods coming into the United States from China were produced by subsidiaries of American corporations operating in China. These are capitalist decisions, and they don't want to be among the losing parts of the world either. And you're going to see arguments in Europe saying, we have to do something here to hold on. There's already a debate inside Germany and beyond Germany, I should say, but particularly in Germany, seriously debating whether Germany is now suffering, quote, deindustrialization. Because the United States, becoming an economic nationalist society because it can't work with Chinese competition, and that's basically what this is. The United States says America first. That's not just against China. They're giving subsidies to companies that are making the decision to leave Belgium and come to the United States because they want the subsidy, and they don't want to be stuck if tariffs get imposed. And so the Europeans are watching a situation in which their weakness is becoming exaggerated because they're not playing. Even if they don't want to be an independent force, they're going to be political voices saying, you have no choice. If you don't take an independent route, you will be wiped out. Your factories will move to the United States, and your people will be buying Chinese automobiles because they are better and cheaper than you can do here in Europe. And you will see your great European car companies, Fiat or Renault or Volkswagen, having more and more difficulties than they already have. All of this is going on, and it points to the fact that what you need in Europe is some basic decisions about genuine unification and a genuine economic program that takes into account the changed world economy. And these are political leaders who show no aptitude to understand what I just said, or to have a program for it, or for that matter, to have a program to do anything else. They simply are going along as if the disaster that they've been presiding over could and should continue. Of course, the British are now going to leave Rishi Sunak and the Conservative Party. If you look at the polls in England, the victory later this year of the Labour Party will be overwhelming. It's a rejection that a person as odd and bizarre as Donald Trump could be in the position he is the same kind of thing here in the United States. It's a protest against normalcy of the sort we've had. And Mr. Biden is seen as the president who has been doing the same thing for 40 years, which is true, he has been. And so Mr. Trump is something new and different. And by being outrageous, he reminds people that he is new and different. And so he gets the vote of people who do not want a continuation of the same. Now, Europe is caught up in this. If they don't do something soon, and it may already be, but if they don't do something soon to deal with this changed reality, then it will be too little and too late.
Richard, you talk about Europe, the difficulties that Europe is dealing with right now. We know that the neocons in the United States, they have some sort of agenda for Europe. If they really think that Russia and China are their enemy and they have to fight with these two enemies, why they're not having a good concept on Europe? Because when you have some sort of alliance with Europe, you have G7, you have NATO, and you want to have your allies being stronger and stronger, it doesn't seem that they're trying to help Europe. The simple question is Europe better off than before this war in Ukraine started?
No, I think the neocon position about Europe has been pretty consistent for quite a while. Europe is to be a wealthy junior partner of the United States. When there's a war that the United States wants to fight, it refers to its military as a coalition, because there are four Canadians, 11 Dutch people, 19 French, and two Polish deserters who join. You know, in other words, this is a joke. This is a politics in which the United States is the dominant power. The great enemy is somewhere else, preferably not a white European country, because that creates all kinds of problems. Remember, the United States is a country of immigrants. So you can, having a war against Germany or Italy or France, that becomes complicated and difficult. And we don't handle that very well. If you remember in World War II, even though the number of Japanese Americans was small, we put them in concentration camps for years in a program that was half racism and half a kind of nationalist paranoia. So my guess is that the neocons are happy that the Europeans are doing their job. They are providing money because they have some, and they're providing troops because they have some, and they're providing military equipment because they have some. And otherwise, they're simply a cheerleading, supporting the United States in the UN and publicly. It allows the neocons to talk, which they do, as though the whole world, I mean, it becomes really frightening in the United States when you listen. We have once again the phrase, the free world. It comes out of the Cold War. It was a clever slogan there to distinguish the United States from communist Soviet Union. Now there is no communist Soviet Union. Now Putin is an enemy and a critic of the Soviet period of Russian history. Makes no difference. We have again a free world, and we just change the name. Instead of denouncing him for being a communist, we denounce him for being an authoritarian. What? You know, we are allies with authoritarians left and right. Every corporation in the United States, we are an economy run by about 1,500 major corporations. You know their name: Apple, General Dynamics, General Motors, all of that. The CEO, the chief executive officer of every one of those corporations, is an authoritarian leader. He's not elected by the people he supervises. He can fire them almost at will, or certainly with a little effort. They all know it. He knows it. He's an authoritarian leader. He has at his disposal billions of dollars with which to buy politicians. But we call other countries authoritarian. But no one is anymore fooled by this, except the American public, which scratches its head. I'm not sure your viewers know, but something like 40% or more of Americans, when polled about Russia, do not know that the Soviet Union and Russia are not the same thing. They think we're still in the Cold War, which is why phrases like the free world, and politicians here talk about the whole world agrees with us about Ukraine. It doesn't. The votes in the UN are crystal clear. They're not reported here, or if reported, not discussed in any way that they become general understanding, understood knowledge. Same with Israel and the Palestinians. Americans are shocked to discover, which no one expected, that the support of young people, of Black and brown people, is tilting more and more toward the Palestinians here in the United States. They're the ones out in the street making the demonstrations. You know, it's that wasn't expected. Mr. Biden is a, you know, supporter of Israel, has been all his adult life. He just went out there, gave them a carte blanche, and assumed that the whole world would support, but they don't. They just don't. And I think what you have to begin to see is that these inabilities to understand, there is not only denial of what's going on in there and a determination to see the world the way it was for 50 years or 75 years, but there are delusions that flow from that kind of denial. That's why you miscalculated the military realities of Ukraine. That's why you miscalculated the economic realities of a sanctions. And let me talk about another miscalculation. A group of sympathizers with Palestinian issues, the Houthis in Yemen, make a decision to do something to support. So they say, we will shoot missiles in the Red Sea at ships that have something to do with Israel, that are carrying goods to or from Israel, or something like that. It's a small act. It's mostly symbolic. It has some consequences because insurers now charge much more to insure a ship going through there, and then they have to go around the Cape, Africa, and all that. But it's still relatively small. The United States has, Pentagon, has flown over 250 bombing raids by American airplanes, joined by a handful of British airplanes, of course, bombing Yemen. It hasn't stopped what the Houthis are doing. It hasn't made the Red Sea one bit safer. It's a failed policy, but they continue. The lesson is to every other Arabic or Muslim country sympathetic with Palestine, which they all are, there are going to be people in those societies who see, let's see, is there something we can do in our country to be supportive, like the Houthis, because they can't stop us. There are too many of us, and what they can do doesn't do much, and we don't care. You cannot mobilize people around the world like this and imagine that you can put out every fire. That has been the downfall of every empire that I know anything about. It's called overreach. When an empire tries to keep itself going by doing too many things against too many people in too many different places, and it can't do it. And then it begins to fall apart. And that's what I see. I see it in my own country here. I see our dysfunction at home, which is only going to get worse. These divisions that we have are very serious. They are not going to be resolved by whoever wins this election. Nobody should imagine. If Mr. Biden wins, Mr. Trump will do what he did after losing last time. And if Mr. Trump wins, it will probably be worse, because you will have a mass of people who have no respect, no willingness to support, no willingness to tolerate. And what is he going to do? Use the army? Too late. The gaps here are becoming unmanageable. And I think people are recognizing it. Whether it's a political official in some African country, or it's the head of a CEO of a major corporation. You want to locate in the United States? Really? You sure? Why don't you locate in Mexico? Is it safer? Wow. For most of the last 200 years, nobody would have thought that. Now they do. I just read an article about a decision to locate in Mexico, not for reasons of tariff and all of that, but because it was considered less dangerous. So for me, I think that the neocons are enjoying the end of their regime. They can't even hold on to the right wing that they used to be able to keep close relations with. The right wing doesn't want the war in Ukraine to continue. That's the one holding up the funding. They can't get them. They certainly can't get the left. They certainly can't get young people. The argument that saving Ukraine is a great political thing against the evil Russians, that's not a durable argument. It gets weaker each day. It's still strong, but it is weaker than it's ever been. And the vista of an unending war there, striking more and more people, is crazy.
You mentioned Victoria Nuland. She was in the Bush administration, in Obama administration, in Biden administration. She was one of the key roles of this conflict in Ukraine. We've learned that she's stepping down. Do you think that after decades of this policy that has failed in Ukraine, is this a sign that we can learn from that the United States is changing their policy in Ukraine, or it doesn't matter if she's there or not?
Well, I certainly don't think it matters whether she's there or not. What matters is whether or not the neocon approach that she's been part of for many years remains the ideological framework of the people who work in the State Department and the military and so on. They always had their differences. It's never been unanimous. Nobody should think that it has. But we'll have to see whether her departure, it could be part of a change. It could be. But unless you're an insider, you can't know what that is. I do think that, especially if Trump wins, that for other reasons and in a very confused way, they might begin to look for some other policy. But I want to stress, nothing Mr. Trump has said indicates that he understands any of this, or that the people around him do. You know, in America, political leaders have to say, America is the richest country in the world. It isn't. It's the most powerful country in the world. Maybe by some measures it is, but by others it isn't. When I explain, for give you an idea, when I explain to my American audiences little details, like the population of China is four times that of the United States, they can't quite digest it. They need to think that the rest of the world is poor, backward, weak, and the United States is the opposite. You know where you saw that? I don't know if you caught the interview that Tucker Carlson did with Vladimir Putin in Russia 2 or 3 weeks ago. Okay, when that came out, there were a bunch of clips of Tucker Carlson, who spent a week or so in Moscow, and he took camera with him, and he went into the subway, and he went into a supermarket, and he went around. And he was like so many Americans. He couldn't get over what he was seeing. He marveled. Here was a supermarket, and you could see a supermarket with, you know, the trays where the meat is kept in a plastic wrap, and then he could go and get some bananas and put them in his little cart that he did. We have supermarkets like that everywhere in the United States. Europe has supermarkets like that everywhere. Asia, Africa, and Latin America more and more have that kind of... He couldn't get over. Look at this, he said. This is a supermarket like the one I have at home. He was amazed. And then he went into the subway. And it was an interesting moment. He looked at the subway and he said, my God, it's clean. It's beautiful. It's brilliantly lit. It has artwork on the walls. And you see all of that. And he goes, my God, I always thought subways have to look like the one in New York. Dirty, broken, full of rats and everything else. I live in New York City. I go into the subway. I know what they're like. And the American commentators who showed these clips were very angry at Tucker Carlson. They didn't like what he was saying. They said, no, in a dictatorial, authoritarian country, they can put together the resources to have showcases like the subway. And I remember thinking, they are so desperate that they have become stupid. You know, if you go to Paris, France, which has never had a Soviet government or anything like it, they have a beautiful subway system. My family is French. I have been in the Parisian subway system 1,000 times in my life. It's much better than the American system. Much quieter, much cleaner, much more elegant. You don't need to have an authoritarian government to have a nice subway system. It's a question of your priorities, that's all. You know, but they're so upset that a conservative talk show host, Tucker Carlson, should have positive things. So he's, and this is serious, the neocons brand people like him an unpatriotic treason, like they do with Trump and so on. And not for reasons that might be interesting and worthwhile, but because he has positive things to say. This is childish. I'll give you a final example from my world. I'm a professor. I spent all my life teaching in American universities. And I early discovered, first as a student and then as a professor, that most of my colleagues in economics have studied conventional micro and macroeconomics, called neoclassical economics and Keynesian, like I have, and they've taught that like I have. But I also was interested in Marxian economics, a critical approach, so I learned that too. They didn't. So when they talk in their way, I understand because I've had to learn and teach. But when I talk using the Marxian apparatus, which I sometimes find useful, they have no idea what I'm talking about. And when I've asked them, gee, that's too bad, they say, no, We are very proud that we did. And I realize I'm talking to people who think of themselves as intellectuals, who think of themselves as scholars, and in their areas, they often are. But they took a pride in not reading one of the major thinkers of the last 300 years. That's a bizarre childishness. My teachers could often not answer my questions, not because they weren't teachers, good teachers, they were. Not because they didn't study the material well, they did. But when it came to questions that required some knowledge of Marxism, they couldn't answer my question because they were proudly avoided picking up the book to read it, to learn from it. And the fact that half the world took that stuff seriously still wasn't enough for them to learn it. So you're dealing with a country whose anxiety about being in control and dominant takes it, well, we all have a little of that, but it went further in the United States. And you're now seeing the cost of it. Yeah, you have your disagreements with Russia, but you don't have to be at war with Russia. Russia wanted to join NATO not that many years ago. Stop. You could work out all kinds of arrangements. Here's an irony. We are now at war with Russia in Ukraine. We never were at war with Russia during the Soviet period. From 1917 to 1989, they were the great, I don't know, evil communism, but we didn't go to war. Now the evil communists have been thrown out by people who are proudly anti-communist, like Putin, and we're at war. It suggests that the whole story of the Cold War was just a story. This is a country that needs to have a dangerous external enemy. And if it isn't communism, it'll be global terrorism. And if it isn't global terrorism, it's Russia. And if it isn't Russia, it'll be China. And if it is, fill in the blank. This is a habit of the political mentality. And it's only a question now of whether that can survive or whether the dead end it has worked itself into is now too much and it can't solve the problem. It could not imagine leaving Afghanistan and turning it over to the Taliban, but that's what they had to do. They cannot face the fact that the American intervention in Iraq has mostly benefited the neighboring country of Iran in terms of its power and its prestige. They can't, but they do somewhere they know. And among them, there are enough people who aren't crazy to let them understand you're not winning in Ukraine either. Yeah, they may make terrible mistakes, but there is a core of brain, of rationality that I think is going to show itself in the weeks and months ahead.
Richard, just to wrap up this session, I want to talk about the Putin's address to nation, in which he said BRICS' share of world economy in purchasing power parity terms will rise to 36.6% by 2028, while G7's share will fall to 27.8%. When it comes to this type of comparison, do you think at the end of the day that would change the behavior of the United States to have some sort of compromise with China or Russia, some sort of cooperation?
Not directly, no. I mean, because it's already been true. Yes, you can have debates about purchasing power parity and otherwise using exchange rates and so on. There are arguments either way. The bottom line basically is that around the year 2020, which is now 4 years old, the two lines crossed, that the declining relative position of the G7 became the same as the rising position of the BRICS. And that since then, the last 3+ years, that difference has gotten worse. In other words, the relative output, relative GDP of the G7 as a share of global output has been shrinking from around 30%. Then you can argue, some say 29, some 28, 27, while the BRICS has gone up from around 30 to 32, 34, maybe some will go even higher. The numbers there, no, they don't matter all that much. They are disputable in details. That doesn't matter either. Nor do I think the numbers per se will persuade anyone. Maybe a few economists who study them. No, here's how it's going to work. The growing wealth of the BRICS nations is going to enable them to do things they couldn't do before. And the shrinking relative wealth of the G7 is going to prevent them from doing things they used to be able to do. That will agitate these two societies. I'll give you quickly examples. A small country in Asia or Africa or Latin America decides it desperately needs a quality educational system or a quality public health system. And it's going to cost, I don't know, $16 billion. And they would like not to have to pay too much for it. Can they get investments? Can they get loans, a package? They used to have to go to London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, or New York. They can still go there, and they can still try to get it, and they may get it. But they will likely also now send a delegation to Beijing and to say to the Chinese, listen, what will you give us? And the Chinese will give them a deal. I know that because they've been doing it now for years in all those places, very successfully. And they're going to offer better terms than the West. And that country is going to take the better terms, not because they like the BRICS better, but because they don't have the money. They need the better deal, and they will. Okay. Now here comes the contrary example. Another country somewhere in the world is having a dispute and calls on the American military to help them. And the American military goes to the president, whoever he is, and says, we can do this, but it will cost an extra $30 billion because it's far away, it's very expensive. So you need to go to Congress to get another $30 billion. But the Congress is going to say, no, we can't. We have too many problems at home that people are angry about. They want money for childcare. They want money for elderly people. They want money for our pension system. They want money for... You can't keep saying no to them and send money into these foreign countries. They know what happened in Afghanistan or Iraq or Vietnam or now Ukraine. They don't want more of that. And they are going to say so. And so the president has to turn to his generals. He's sorry, but they can't do it. That's going to happen. Lots of little moments like that are going to happen. You're going to see initiatives by right-wing, left-wing congressional groups pushing for what they want and discovering that if the president wants to do something militarily in the Far East, they can make a deal. Okay, we'll give you the money to go and do something stupid in Taiwan, but only if you give us X. But he can't give them X because they don't have the money. And how's he going to get it? He can't borrow more. The United States debt is now $34 trillion. It's too much. it's frightening people. So he can't do that. He can't raise taxes because that's impossible in American politics. So he has to say no. This is a new experience. They're not good at that. They've been printing money like crazy for the last 25 years because they don't want to raise taxes. So they borrow and print the money. The one part of the government, the Federal Reserve, prints the money to lend it to the U.S. Treasury, which borrows it to finance domestic spending and foreign spending. And everybody understands that will hit a limit. No one quite knows what the limit will be. But if interest rates stay high, then that debt is expensive to carry, and that's going to make budget issues very difficult, blah, blah, blah. So you're seeing, well, I cannot tell you, and nobody can, is whether this will reach its limits next year or a decade from now. That's the unknown at this point. And that depends on many other variables. But I would assure you that the American economy is weaker today than it has been at any point in my lifetime. And most of my colleagues, left-wingers, right-wingers, and those in the middle, agree. We don't agree on why it's this way, and we don't agree on what to do about it. But the interesting thing is we do agree this is really bad. And so when Mr. Trump attacks it and we don't like Mr. Trump, we're uncomfortable. When Mr. Biden defends it, we have a great economy, we're also uncomfortable. One doesn't know what he's talking about, and the other one is simply pretending so he doesn't have to see it. And this is not a good sign. Our problem is not that the two candidates for president are very, very old and have serious mental problems, which everybody sees. That's not our problem. Our problem is neither of them admits the changed position of the United States. Neither has a plan for what to do about it. And so we continue, like the war in Ukraine, doing the same thing we've been doing, expecting a different outcome, and that's insane.
Thank you, Richard, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always, to talk with you and learn from you.
Well, I really appreciate your making these videos and sharing them. You know, it's an opportunity for me and people like me to make our case, to help people think about this in ways that the mainstream media do not allow. And so it's up to folks like you to fill in the missing area.
Thank you.
So I thank you every bit as much as you thank me.
My pleasure, Richard.